You're listening to MLB.com Extras, brought to you by MLB.tv. It's baseball everywhere.
Hey everyone, this is Tim McMaster for MLB.com Extras, taking you around the National League East with less than 2 weeks to go to the trade deadline. Some of the best teams in the East ready to make their moves, make a move to improve their club down the stretch. Let's start with the first place Nationals and our MLB.com Nationals reporter, Bill Ladson.
Bill, the Nationals just keep plugging along here, and they've gotten good stuff from Strasburg after the break, and this team looks like it's in a great spot right now. So we'll take this chance as we get back into the second half of the season to kind of reset things for this national team. Obviously, just a couple of weeks to go before the trade deadline, and this team, I think, has some moves that it probably needs to make if it really wants to be a World Series contender. Let's start by talking about Steven Strasburg a little bit, because he took some time, obviously, with the little nicks and injuries. He didn't pitch in the All-Star game back in his hometown. I know in a way that had to be a little bit of a disappointment, but it seemed like he kind of had the bigger picture in mind as far as this team goes. And he comes out of the break and right back at it. He improves to 13-0 on the season. He's only the fifth player to do that, joining teammate Max Scherzer, who did it back with the Tigers. But it seems like a little extra rest for Strasburg and not pitching in San Diego could be the best thing for him, and he seems locked in to go in the second half of the season.
True. They were looking at the big picture. I'm talking about Strasburg and the Nationals. And, you know, I don't think it was a big deal that he didn't pitch in San Diego in the All-Star game. I think the bottom line is he finally wants to win a championship. You know, they had a chance in 12 and 14, and I think Strasburg realizes that, and years now to win it all.
Yeah, the last thing he wants is to not be available in October. He's been through that. He knows how frustrating that is. When you see what he's done, the 13-0, obviously we talk about the value of a win and how much value there is in that. But 13-0 is still something. How much has he impressed you this season, Bill, to go to this point and he still hasn't taken a loss?
You know, it's impressive in the sense that he's healthy. That's the bottom line. And you know what? Now it looks like he's going deeper in games now. I mean, you know, in the past, it seems like because they were treating him with kid gloves. I mean, he was pitching like 5 to 6 innings. Now he's going like 7 and 8 innings. And I like to see the day he pitches his second complete game. He has one in his career. I think there's more to come. And I think the big deal is he's just healthy. That's the number one issue. That's been his problem the entire time he's been with the Nationals. And I think he will continue to be one of the best pitchers this year.
Yeah, with the amount of money that they've kind of invested in him now going forward, they need him to be a guy that goes deep into games and really is that go-to guy for this team. All right, speaking of guys that could be future aces, Lucas Giolito back down in the minors now. Do you expect that we'll see him again at some point in 2016?
You know, Tim, that's hard to say. And the reason I say that is how he was hit hard by the Mets. I mean, like, it was also, in my opinion, a confidence issue. He said, like, after the game at Citi Field that when, you know, after he got hit early, he kind of lost his focus and everything. So I think there needs to be some improvement in terms of his location, his breaking ball, which Dusty Baker has said. And you know, it's a confidence issue, I think. And we'll see when he gets back. Right now, I have to say, no, we will not see him in 2016 until next year.
Yeah, and they certainly, as things sit right now, don't really need him, and you hope everybody stays healthy, and that continues to be the thing. And the location seems like it's the one thing that Giolito, throughout his career to this point, hasn't quite been able to figure out on a consistent basis. So it's that one last hurdle, I guess, before he can really realize that potential, become an ace at the major league level. All right, that brings us to the trade deadline, Bill. And the Nationals, they're a team that doesn't have a lot of holes, but there are certainly some things that can be done here to improve this team. I think the one thing that jumps out is the bullpen, and we've talked about it before. Chapman, would they be in on him? What kind of a player would they bring in to help out at the back end, or either before Papelbon or after Papelbon. What type of player do you see them going after over the next 2 weeks?
There's no question they're going after a guy like Chapman and Andrew Miller. There's no question that you know a Chapman played for Dusty Baker in Cincinnati. I they're going to have to give up, you know, almost a king's ransom to get that done, I believe. I mean, if the Yankees are true to their word, they're trying to improve the farm system. Looks like they're going to have to try and, you know, get rid of, not get rid of, but try to acquire some of their, the Nationals farm system. Also, I think, to tell you the truth, they need more than their bullpen help. I think they need another bat in that lineup. And, you know, if you look at their leadoff hitters, hitting 211, 255 on base, and also, I just think they need another power hitter or leadoff hitter, whatever. But I think something's got to be done on offense, too.
When you look at the bats available, leadoff might be a little tough to come by, but Jay Bruce, very much available for the Cincinnati Reds. He's a guy who could certainly provide some power. Now, if they bring in a corner outfielder, Carlos Beltran, another guy with the Yankees, is another guy available. How does Bryce Harper feel about moving to center field, Bill?
Well, that's something I'm going to have to ask him today. He's asking me, you know, I'm going to ask him today. We'll see what happens. I think he will do it. He's done it before. I think he'll do it again. I don't think he's a bad center fielder. It's not Gold Gloves, but he's. I think he's good enough to last this season at least. And you know, we'll see who they will acquire. It'll be interesting to see.
It could always be a situation where you could see late in games, maybe Harper moves back over to a corner and they throw somebody like a Ben Revere in there to replacement center for defensive replacement. Certainly going to be interesting. When you talk about who it would take, obviously, Andrew Miller, they'd have to give up a lot more than Aroldis Chapman because Miller has a great contract for a number of years, whereas Chapman would just be a rental. Would the Nationals consider trading Trey Turner? Or I would think Giolito is off the board, but would they consider trading a Lucas Giolito or a Trey Turner to get what they need in return?
You know, it would not surprise me, Tim. Let me tell you something. I don't know what Trey Turner's future here with the Nationals is right now, because obviously he's not going to play shortstop, he's not going to play second base for obvious reasons. And Dusty Baker has said already that it's not a tryout in terms of putting Turner in center field, and he hasn't done it yet. So I have to believe that Trey Turner could be traded before the deadline, and Giolito as well. I mean, they, you know, the Nationals to me have enough pitching to survive if they did trade a Giolito. So, again, I'm speculating, but I think they're in good shape in trying to make a deal.
Anthony, we're going to kind of reset here as the Mets get ready for, or they're into the second half of the season. But last time we talked was before the All-Star break, so now we're a couple of weeks away from the deadline. We're into the second half of the season. And the Mets are in Chicago right now. You're with them, and they're on the field as we speak. But I want to start by talking about Tuesday night, because it was a game that could have easily gotten away from the Mets in the ninth, but instead they come away with really an amazing victory. Bases loaded, nobody out, and they have to face some tough batters, and somehow they get out of it and get the win. How big a win was that for the Mets?
Well, it's a huge win, and it's not somehow they got out of it, Tim.
Right,
it's
not fair. That's fair.
It's
true.
Exactly. It's Jiris Familia is how they got out of it, and yes, he got them into that jam. But for whatever reason, I feel like this guy gets a little bit of a bad rap. I feel like those three blown saves in the World Series, which were largely not his fault, have stained his reputation, when his reputation should be one of the best, if not the best, closer in baseball. You know, he's got 49 consecutive regular season saves that he's converted. He throws 98. He has that nasty sinker that people know it's coming and just can't hit it anyway. So I think just he's a really maybe underappreciated part of this team and should probably deserve a little more love from Mets fans. But to answer your question, yeah, it was a huge win. I think this is a Mets team that's at a critical juncture of their season. They're at a point when, you know, things could go south in a hurry, or they could really, you know, make a nice run and get themselves back into a good standing in the National League wild card and even in the division. So a really important time for the Mets to play well this two-week stretch between the All-Star break and the trade deadline, and really see where they stand once those chips fall on August 1st.
It was amazing, too, the similarities you see Familia get out of it in Chicago. And he was in a similar situation against the Cubs at Citi Field just a couple of weeks ago, and he got out of that one as well. So the Cubs can't quite get to Familia, and he has been great, and he does deserve that credit, obviously. You mentioned that this team kind of could go two ways. And since we last did this podcast, Anthony, Harvey had the surgery, the thoracic outlet syndrome. He's out for the year. This team has taken some pretty big punches, but they're still hanging in there. And I think that says a lot. Now you have Conforto back up, obviously, Nimmo back down. Cespedes is banged up a little bit now, and that caused Conforto to move over to right field on Tuesday night. He makes a great play out there. Conforto went down to the minors, and it seemed like he went down with the right mindset. He went to Vegas, and he hit well down there. Now he's back up. How locked in is he now? How does he feel about the time down there and being back up in the majors?
Well, look, he was the first one to admit that when he first went down, he was upset. He wasn't happy about it, and it took him a couple of days, as it should, really, to get his head screwed back on right. But once Michael Conforto did do that, he started hitting, and really he started raking down there. He's too good for AAA, and really when he's right, he's one of the better young hitters in the National League. So I think you're seeing that now. I think you're seeing a guy who needed that little minor league stint to get himself back to where he should be. And I don't think there's a ton of concern that anything like this is going to happen again to Michael Conforto now. Will he have little times when he struggles? Of course, everyone does, especially young players. But I think by and large, you're going to see him be a productive hitter. Like you said, it's just a matter now of where is he going to play defensively. He's a left fielder. That's pretty much all he's done defensively throughout his pro career. But Yoenis Cespedes is a Mets left fielder now, and he doesn't want to play center, and the Mets don't want him to play center with that bad right leg that he's got. So if they want both Cespedes and Conforto in the lineup, which of course they do, the Mets are going to have to be a little creative here. That might ultimately mean playing Conforto in center field, which doesn't seem to be like an ideal match on paper for a guy who's not the fastest, not the most athletic, and certainly has virtually zero experience in center field. You might see him a little bit in right field, like you did on Tuesday night. Curtis Granderson can play center in a pinch, even though the Mets don't love that alignment. So it's going to be a little bit of everything while the Mets figure this out. And I actually think it's kind of one of the more interesting sort of personnel decisions the Mets are going to have to make over the next 2, 3, 4 weeks is, if everyone's healthy, how are they going to figure out a way to get both Cespedes and Conforto into the lineup pretty much every day?
And you have to somehow still be a good defensive team as well. So certainly it will be challenging. Let's talk about Jacob DeGrom a little, Anthony, because as good as DeGrom's been throughout his career, on Sunday he kind of took it to another level. First career complete game, first shutout to go along with that. It's a one-hitter, and if it had gone differently, you'd probably feel even different about it because he gives up just the one hit, and it was to the pitcher, but because it was in the third inning, you don't talk about the fact that he maybe, you know, flirted with a no-hitter or anything like that. But how good was DeGrom on Sunday at the ballpark in the press box witnessing it?
Oh, he was sensational, and really he's been the key to what's been holding this Mets team together by and large. I mean, look at where the Mets were early this season, and Syndergaard was pitching great, but Matt Harvey certainly had his issues at the time. Steven Matz was pitching great, but he was already having some injury concerns, and so on and so forth down the line. Well, now Harvey's out for the year. Matz has a bone spur, and he's been shaky at best in recent weeks. Noah Syndergaard has a bone spur, he's had some arm fatigue, and he also has not been what we've seen from him in the past. Bartolo Colon's been pretty steady, but certainly he's not that top-of-the-rotation guy for the Mets. So Jacob DeGrom is the one who stepped up really in a huge way and has developed back into the ace that he's been in the past for the Mets, and they really need it. I've said often this season that, you know, if you had one game to pitch, even when Matt Harvey was healthy, when all these guys were healthy and not dealing with anything, you had one game to pitch that you needed to win I would give it to Jacob DeGrom regardless of what the numbers say. He's just got a growing track record of being able to come up big in the biggest spots, of being able to succeed on days when he doesn't wake up with his best stuff. If the Mets want to go anywhere this season and into October, they're going to need Jacob DeGrom to be healthy, to be pitching, and to be succeeding, because you see this weekend what he is when he's right. He's still one of the best pitchers in baseball.
Todd, the second half is underway. It's been a couple of weeks since we talked on the podcast before the All-Star break, and now we're sitting at a point with a couple of weeks to go until that trade deadline. It's a little different, I feel like, for the Phillies this year than it was a year ago. A year ago, this team had to make trades. They had players they had to send away to get prospects in return, and they did exactly that. They did a tremendous job of turning the roster over and getting younger. Obviously, this roster, when you look at it, is younger and has a lot less tradable parts, but there are still some guys that could go. So let's start there. Let's just jump right into this trade deadline scenario, because you have guys like Jeremy Hellickson, Peter Borges, Jenmar Gomez, a whole list of guys who could be dealt, none of which I think are going to bring back a huge return. So what is the Phillies' approach over the next 2 weeks?
Well, yeah, you're right. I don't think that the Phillies are going into this trade deadline saying, you know, we have to get a big haul for Hellickson or Borges or whomever. I think they're very realistic. I think they know that, you know, they're not going to get as big, a top prospect for any of these guys. But I also think they're in an interesting situation where, unlike last year, like you said, they're not forced or pressured into trading anybody. So, you know, if they finish the season with Jeremy Hellickson, that could actually benefit the young pitchers in the rotation. That's not the worst thing in the world. So they're not going to be like, let's just take whatever we can get for Jeremy Hellickson. Let's just take whatever we can get for Peter Borges and move on. They're going to be motivated to trade these guys, but I also don't think they're going to give them away. So if a team can step up and give them something fair, I'm just saying, like, you know, a Class A prospect, you know, a pretty decent prospect, maybe like a number 10 prospect in an organization for one of these guys, you know, that might get the ball rolling a little bit. So it's going to be interesting. I think, you know, Hellickson has a very good chance of being moved. There's a lot of teams that need starting pitching. He's attractive because he's pitched pretty well this season. He would really shore up the back end of a rotation. You know that he isn't going to be scared out there. He pitched in the American League coming up with the Rays. So, you know, he's not scared of going through an American League lineup. He's done it before and enjoyed some success. Peter Borges is really interesting. You know, a month and a half ago, you would thought the Phillies were ready to DFA him, but he has been absolutely on fire for about the last month and a half, playing great, great baseball. And suddenly he becomes pretty interesting because he can play great defense. We know that. He can play center field. He's been playing right field all season. He can run the bases very well, and now he's hitting the ball well. He's not a power hitter, but he's been hitting doubles, triples, and home runs at a pretty good clip. So I think for a team looking for outfield help, maybe looking for some top-of-the-order help, Peter Borges is a guy to keep an eye on, and I think there's going to be a lot of interest in him as well.
Yeah, and just talking to Bill Ladson with the Nationals, he mentioned the Nationals being interested in maybe adding a leadoff type guy that can play a corner outfield spot, that can move Bryce Harper over. Maybe Peter Borges would be a fit there. As far as the Phillies go, they're also getting Aaron Altherr back at some point. He's kind of making his rehab. That makes Borges even more tradable, right? Because at some point, you're just going to need that roster spot.
Absolutely. That's another point, really, with Hellickson and Borges. Aaron Altherr is going to be back, I think he's due back. He has to be activated by July 28th, and they want him to play. They want to see him the last, you know, 2 months of the season, so you have to move somebody. And Borges, obviously, like we just said, is an obvious candidate to be moved. At some point, Nick Williams, one of their top prospects in AAA, might get promoted. So there's a lot of motivation. Again, they don't necessarily want to give these guys away. They also are motivated to talk to some teams and come up with the right deal, because Altherr is coming back soon. Nick Williams could be promoted soon. The same thing for Jeremy Hellickson. Jake Thompson, their top pitching prospect in AAA, has been pitching ridiculously well over his last 7 or 8 starts, an ERA of under 1, I believe. So they would like to get him up at some point as well, because he's going to be a big part of this rotation going forward. So, that again, that's more motivation to try to find a trade partner for Jeremy Hellickson. So in terms of outfield and rotation, they would like to get something done, I believe, you know, as long as, again, they're not going to just, you know, you got some kind of very marginal, a one in a million shot he hits type prospect. Well, I don't see the Phillies taking a deal like that for Hellickson or Borges. But if they can get something fair, I think they'll jump on it.
I know the attitude for this team from the manager coming into the second half was, hey, you know what, why not us in the wild card? Maybe we can get hot and make a run. Not a great start to the second half. Obviously a brutal loss on Monday night to the Marlins to have a 2-0 lead in the ninth inning and to lose it and then go on to lose in 11. But there's still been some more bright notes lately for this team when you look at the younger players. Aaron Nola is a guy who obviously had a great start to the season. And then on this podcast, we talked about it a little bit, Todd. He really, I think you said it, faced the first adversity of his life when it comes to baseball over the last month. But a nice start from him last time out. Six scoreless innings, a couple of hits. It seems like he's kind of figuring it out again.
Yeah, he really did look like his old self Monday night against the Marlins, and that is encouraging. A lot of people were asking me, like, are the Phillies concerned? Are you worried about Aaron Nola? I really wasn't because, you know, it's not like his velocity dipped. It's not like he was injured. He was just going through a little bit of a rough patch, and Cameron Rupp, the Phillies catcher, said after Monday night's game, he thought, you know, hey, he might have been just a little bit tired, maybe a little bit fatigued going into the All-Star break. It's his first full big league season. He had been pitching really well the first half of the season, pitching deep into a lot of games. And for that reason, he might have just needed a little bit of a break. And you know, he said he didn't really need that mental break, but, you know, it's certainly just to get away from the game, kind of decompress a little bit, I don't think hurt him either. So that break, based off of his effort on Monday night, I think is very encouraging. And I think going forward, you're going to see Aaron Nola kind of finish the season strong. And then when you look at this rotation going into next season, assuming everybody stays healthy, Nola, Eichhoff, Vince Velasquez, if Jake Thoms gets promoted, and if Zach Eflin can keep pitching well, boy, you're looking at a pretty solid, very, very young, very talented rotation going forward.
Yeah, that's good stuff. And a young staff, maybe you add somebody to that puzzle at some point once you're ready to contend again. And I think this team is looking good as far as the rotation goes. Michael Franco is another guy who's been on a tear lately, Todd. He's looking like, I think, the all-star type third baseman that they thought he would be this year. Obviously, the tough first half. But how much of this, I guess there was a Ryan Howard, Carlos Ruiz kind of got together with Franco, told him to relax a little bit. Can you kind of, what's the story behind that?
Yeah, it was in late June. The Phillies offense was you know, terrible. You can say that's putting it mildly. For you know, through the end of June and over that month span going into late June, everybody was really pressing. And the first game in Minnesota, I believe it was June 21st, 23rd, or it was in that week. They had their pre-series hitters meeting. And where they go over all the pitchers and whatnot. But in that meeting, Ryan Howard and Carlos Ruiz got up and just said, listen, guys, we're trying way too hard here. I've been through these battles before, these struggles before. Everybody's got to relax, just kind of do their thing. And wouldn't you know it, coincidence or not, all these young players seemed to kind of relax and try to and stop trying to do too much. You heard Pete McCann talk a lot about that the first 2.5 months of the season. I think these young guys are really trying to do too much. And especially Michael Franco, I think he enjoyed so much success last year. And I think once they started him in that number three spot to start the season, he's like, okay, I've got to hit a lot of home runs. And I've got to drive in a lot of runs. And it wasn't happening early. So you started seeing really swinging wildly in the batter's box at a lot of pitches he had no business swinging at. You know, he's going to strike out a lot, yes, but some of these at-bats just did not look good. And what we've seen now since then, he will swing out of his shoes every once in a while, yes. But I've also seen the last four games since the All-Star break, there's been a runner on third base, or he's needed to advance a runner. He's got two strikes on him, and he just kind of puts the ball in play. He's hit a couple ground balls at second base, knocked in a couple of runs. And that's, I think, a very encouraging sign where he's not sitting there like, I got to hit a home run every time. He goes, okay, runner on third. Got two strikes. I'm probably not going to get anything great to hit here. Let's just put the ball in play and get this run home. And he's done it. And I think that's part of like the growing process for him. He's getting more comfortable. He's a little bit more relaxed. And I think, yeah, some of that can kind of go back to that meeting in Minnesota in late June when Howard and Carlos Ruiz said, guys, listen, we played a lot of baseball games. We've seen a lot of guys struggle. Pressing and trying too hard is not going to help anybody. Let's just relax, go out and have fun and let our talents take over. And it seems to have worked.
Mark, first podcast of the second half of the season. We can kind of reset the stage for this team heading into the second half. And of course, the trade deadline, less than 2 weeks away at this point. So we'll see what the Braves, if they're busy selling anybody, if there's anybody that they could get something back for at this point in the season. It's certainly always an interesting time, the end of July. All right, let's start with, I think, some good news. Tyrell Jenkins, two starts, has been pretty good for this team. Last time out, six innings, four hits, two runs. Is that experiment what the Braves were hoping it would be so far, Mark?
Yeah, I think so. I think it's somewhat of an unexpected experiment, but at the same time, you know, there's no sense of then giving starts to De La Cruz or, well, you're going to continue to give them to Harold. But while Williams Perez and these guys, some wear and Blair battles back, you know, to get back to the rotation, it only makes sense to get Tyrell these starts to get a better feel. I think that everyone in the organization, you know, the assumption is that Tyrell will probably end up in the bullpen. But at the same time, why not give him a chance to start right now? He needs to develop a third pitch. This gives him a much better opportunity to do so than he was in the role he was in there in the bullpen, where, you know, for about a month, I think he was up for about a month and made probably four or five relief appearances. So it makes sense to give him a chance to work in this role. You may get a better feel for what he could potentially do. At the same time, you're giving him a chance to get a better feel for a third pitch and show you what kind of makeup he has in that starting role.
Yeah, and certainly just get comfortable at the major league level as well. Tyler Flowers has gone down now, Mark, out 4 to 6 weeks, that broken left hand. So they've called up Anthony Recker. Give a chance for him to show something and see what he can do as the backup catcher here. But I think the injury brings up a big question of what is this team going to do as far as the catching position goes going forward into 2017? Because there's no clear, obvious thing there, no obvious choice. Are the Braves going to make a move? Are they going to bring in a catcher? What is your best bet as to what they're going to do for that backstop position in the future?
Well, you know, I think that this is a question that probably existed even if the hand injury had not occurred. Had Tyler not broken his hand there that last week before the break, this question was there. Now it's at the forefront because you basically have you've got A.J. Brzezinski and Anthony Recker. Neither one of them do you want them to be a primary catcher. It didn't take them long to show, look, they brought Recker up here, assuming that, you know, play A.J., put him in the primary role. Well, first 2 days after the break, they had a total of, I believe it was eight wild pitches and, you know, one pass ball. Now, hey, look, maybe some of those pitches he couldn't handle, but at the same time, this has been a problem throughout the season. He's 39 years old. He shouldn't be relied on to play every day. You know, when he's been asked to do so, it's shown that, you know, he can't do that at this stage of his career. So at this point in time, you're looking at Anthony Recker being probably the primary guy for the next month, unless they go and get a veteran guy. Now, at the top of the list, everyone wants to say, okay, go get Luke Roy. Well, look, there are other teams that are vying for Luke Roy right now, which, you know, increased demand, that price tag is going to go up. Here's a guy who will be a free agent after 2017. At the same time, he's in this, you know, he's right there at that age there, the early 30s, where you have to be hesitant to give a long-term deal to a catcher. That's one of the reasons Brian McCann had to go elsewhere. So I do think, hey, look, and if, speaking of Brian McCann, I know that this talk, you know, when we've written these articles the last week or so about going to get a catcher, the fans have said, you know, can they go get McCann again? Well, look, they're not going to go get McCann if they have to pay that salary over the next few years, the remaining years of his contract. So that would have to be one of those deals where the Yankees would have to be willing to eat a portion of that contract. What I would say to that is I don't see that as the most likely option happening right now.
Yeah, and the Yankees, I would think, as much as people talk about them maybe finally selling, I don't know if they're going to go to the point where they're selling a Brian McCann, but only time will tell. As far as the trade deadline does go, obviously bringing in a catcher would be a move for the future here for the Braves, but you got to talk about the guys that they have on the roster that other teams are interested in, Mark, and whether or not maybe the Braves are interested in moving some of them to continue to bring in younger talent. And I think the one guy on this roster that any team that needs starting pitching would be interested in is Julio Teheran, but we've talked about it on this podcast. The season he's had and the contract he has and the control that he has left, he looks more and more valuable to the Braves, I think, that they wouldn't deal him. Do they need to be blown away to trade Teheran away?
Yes, exactly. I think the way I've written it many times is it has to be a Shelby Miller-type return where they got Dansby Swanson, Aaron Blair and Ender Inciarte. It has to be better than that return. And I don't think that's necessarily going to happen. And even if they get something where they're tempted, the Braves have to step back and say, hey, look, what do we want to do the next few years? You trade Julio Teheran right now, all of a sudden you're going into next year with Mike Foltynewicz and Whistler at the top of your rotation. Maybe you go out and get a veteran, a stopgap, a short-term guy. But the part of the luxury of having Julio Teheran is you already have that guy who's going to make an average of basically $9 million over the next four seasons. I mean, think about the cost of pitching. What you're going to go out there and spend on a guy, a guy who could at least provide you some stability. You're going to go ahead and spend your money elsewhere and may not get the same return on the mound. So if I had to guess right now, I'll put the number at 75% chance that Julio stays. I'd probably put that higher, but I think we probably had this conversation back in December where I was feeling quite, a similar way about Shelby Miller. So I've learned that you never know what kind of offers are going to be made to where the Braves would have no choice but to say no. But for right now, I'd say that Julio will stay there. At the same time, I'm monitoring, what's going on with the Cubs, with the Rangers especially, with the Rangers rotation as it's falling apart. Does that push them to a point where they make you an offer that you absolutely can't refuse? Hey, that's what makes these last couple weeks leading up to the trade deadline fun, because, you never know what's going to transpire.
You mentioned Shelby Miller, and boy, Mark, that trade just looks better and better, doesn't it? He gets optioned to AAA by the Diamondbacks, and it's just been a disastrous season for Arizona so far. But Miller to be optioned to AAA, and it seems like Swanson's just getting closer and closer to the big leagues. That deal looks better and better. As far as other guys the Braves could move, you have names like Jeff Francoeur, Jim Johnson, Rodas Vizcaíno. Who are the most likely guys that maybe the Braves can send off and get something with some value in return?
Boy, a month ago we're sitting there going, they may be able to get some for this guy. Right now, here's a guy who struggled when he was forced to pitch on a regular basis there in June. Then, of course, now he has the oblique injury. You look at a playoff contending team. When could they get him into their bullpen? It's probably early September. So I think that the significant value for this guy, has disappeared. I do expect him to stay as well. If you're going to look for a big piece and it's not Julio Teheran, if you're looking to make a significant trade here before the deadline, to get a bat for the future, you're going to have to give up some of your prospects, and I don't see that happening now. That's something that would probably more likely happen during the off season. Let's look at Jim Johnson. I think that there may be some teams that say, "Look, I'd like some depth in my bullpen." At the same time, they're not going to give up a lot for a guy who basically has faltered. The previous times he's been traded, you remember him going to the A's from the Orioles, going to the Dodgers last year from the Braves. I think that there will be some interest. He probably does end up getting moved. I don't think there's going to be significant value. One name that's interesting is Nick Markakis. Some teams do like the thought of putting his bat just for some consistency in their lineup, but here's a corner outfielder who no longer possesses power, and at the same time, his arm strength is not what it once was. So you have to know what you're getting. I think that the Braves will be more than willing to move him. I guess it comes down to how much of the $22 million he's owed over the next 3 years a team would be willing to take on. Because I do believe even if the Braves move him, they will have to eat a portion of that $22 million.
Joe, it's our first podcast of the second half after a nice all-star breakout in San Diego. And the Marlins, they're in a good position right now. I think if you told this team before the season started that they'd be in it at this point, obviously they'd rather be closer to that Nationals team. But as far as the wild card goes, they're right in the thick of things. If you had told Don Mattingly and company at the beginning of the season this is where they would be right now, do you think they would have taken it and been happy to be in this position?
Tim, absolutely, and especially when you consider Steve Gordon, 80-game suspension, which is winding down, and Giancarlo Stanton underperforming by his standards in the first half. So, a lot went right, in terms of, the rest of the team stepping up. Kind of, I think what I saw in the first half, Tim, and what I saw immediately coming out of break in St. Louis was this is a team growing up. This was a young team with a lot of young talented players, the Christian Yeliches, the J.T. Realmutos, obviously the Jose Fernandez, and they are just hitting their stride and playing very good baseball. And I anticipate they're going to be highly active before the end of the month in terms of trying to upgrade is the word that they've used a lot, the rotation, and maybe get another bullpen arm or wherever else they feel depth can come from. And I think it's going to be a very exciting end of the season for the Mets.
As we record this on Monday, Joe, it's been a week since Giancarlo Stanton's amazing performance out at the All-Star Game, 61 home runs in that Derby to win it, and it seems like he's kind of taken that momentum. I know he finished off the first half in a good spot, and then he goes to San Diego. He wins the Derby, and it seems like he's taking that right into the second half. Is this the scary time for pitchers in the National League facing Giancarlo Stanton?
Yeah, it certainly is looking that way. He's not chasing. I think he's healthy. I think we talked briefly about it in the first half, but I wasn't sure if he was completely healthy. He had some stuff going on. They called it the side, whether it's a little bit of an oblique. I don't think his hand, he had the hemate surgery, at the end of last year. It knocked him out the second half of last year. And I don't think the strength in the hand was fully where he wanted it to be the first month or two in terms of his recovery. But he seems really locked in. He seems, he's back in the cleanup spot ahead of Ozuna, their all-star center fielder, who's doing fine no matter where they put him. Justin Bour is also out. When he comes back, you're going to have Stanton, Ozuna, and Bour. All three are going to hit well over 20 homers, probably 30. So there's a lot of thunder there, and with Stanton having protection around him and Stanton, it's going to be real interesting, Tim, because this seems to be the first time that the Marlins in Stanton's career are going to be in the second half with legitimate playoff implications, and it won't be like Stanton will just be, okay, let's see if he can lead the league in homers or driving 100 on a bad team. It's going to be, let's see how he does in the context of a contender and if he can kind of become what the Marlins certainly feel he is, a legitimate, MVP and one of the best players in the league type player. I'm not saying he's going to win the MVP this year because of the bad first half, but, he's certainly capable of carrying this team the second half and performing at the level of the highest players in the game.
Yeah, and eventually get D. Gordon back as well. This lineup could certainly be scary when everybody is healthy. One more thing from the All-Star Game, Joe. David Ortiz and Jose Fernandez had kind of a fun back and forth with Fernandez pitching to him. Eventually it ends up in a walk, and Ortiz gets the cheer from everybody. But then afterwards, Ortiz and his presser talked multiple times about, he thought Jose was going to be on the Red Sox and they'd love to get that guy. Obviously the Marlins are in a pennant race and they're not trading Jose Fernandez. But how did those comments come across in Miami? Did they upset some people?
Well, I think they upset the league because I think the Red Sox have been reprimanded. Actually, I kind of know they have been. And, now he's the second one to say that with Pedro Martinez being the first. So I guess they could go down the line and kind of wish Jose would be there. But it's upsetting to the Marlins because this is a team that is, certainly primed to make a really good run. They got a fan base that's trying to buy in. and anything that says to the contrary that they're going to sell off a player, you know, especially their ace, you know, I think it was kind of inappropriate, you know, comments by David Ortiz. I don't think he really meant it to be offensive, but, you know, a lot of that will be brushed aside. The Marlins have bigger things to worry about, and Jose Fernandez isn't a free agent until after the 2018 season. So, you know, it's all, you know, speculation, and it's all, you know, good hearsay, and it's a big established market trying to get a great player. But, you know, in the context of Miami and the Marlins, I think that the league will say what they have to the Red Sox, and then they'll move on.
Yeah, I think Ortiz is more having fun than anything else. He's a guy that obviously says what he wants to say all the time and had some fun with that. It was after, obviously, facing off for Fernandez. Speaking of Jose Fernandez, the numbers continue to pile up, Joe. On Monday night, he gets his 500th strikeout, threw a lot of pitches, but he was dominant again. He tied his career high with 14 strikeouts again. But historically, he's the third fastest to 500 strikeouts as far as starts go, behind Yu Darvish and Doc Gooden. He's the fastest as far as innings go for a starter, 400 innings. He just edges out Darvish in that category. You have to wonder, if it hadn't been for the injury and basically the last season, at this point, the numbers he'd be putting up at this age would be kind of amazing. But it seems like he's getting stronger maybe as this season goes on and not tiring. And I'm sure maybe the Marlins had some concerns that as the innings piled up, he'd get a little tired this season. But so far, he looks fine.
Yeah, I mean, they're trying to get him to that range of, you know, 180 to 200. I think he kind of is tracking at 30 starts and about, if he goes six or so innings to start, did about 185 innings for the season. And that's the goal. I mean, he's an ace on the team, you know, trying to go and dethrone the Mets and make the National summer really, really uncomfortable. So they're going to need him to pitch at that level. And, yeah, I mean, he's racking up a ton of strikeouts, but the 20, 25 pitch first innings are coming at the cost of that, and he's never pitched eight innings in his entire career. So, you know, here's a guy that, you know, they love the strikeouts, but, you know, I think they trade a few of those for some early contact and some easier innings instead of having to go five, six pitches with everyone. But certainly whenever he gets in trouble, the strikeout pitch is there to bail him out, mainly a slider. And, you know, I think he's still learning how to pitch. He's still learning how to pace himself. But, you know, he's certainly a star of the game and one of the faces of this franchise, one of the more exciting players in the game. And, yeah, that's just going to be the case with him is, does he tire at the end? I don't imagine he will too much this year. Maybe there'll be repercussions next year because he'll be making a pretty big jump in innings. But, you know, he's kind of locked in. He's young. He's strong. He'll be 24 at the end of this month. And, you know, he's a big reason why they are where they are.
Yeah, the maturation as far as being economical with the pitches seems like it's generally the last thing that aces kind of figure out. You don't have to strike everybody out. You can get guys to chase bad pitches and ground out. It works just as well. We mentioned the deadline, Joe, and obviously Fernando Rodney already a good addition to this bullpen. The lineup looks like it's in good shape. Where do they go? What's the piece that's missing from this team? Is it that fifth starter? Is it more help to the bullpen? What kind of player do you think they could get?
Yeah, they're looking at rotation help, as are pretty much everyone in contention. So it's going to be real fascinating because, you know, a word I used earlier in the podcast, Tim, was the word upgrade. That's kind of a word that, you know, part of the new regime in the front office has said they just – tried to upgrade. In the perfect world, they could get a number two that's ideally situated behind Jose, and then they, you know, can match with Scherzer and Strasburg, you know, Jose and whoever the pitcher is. But I'm not sure that player, that pitcher, is going to be available. And you still need a few teams. Are the Yankees still in it? Are they going to say they're out at the end? So I think right now you're looking at like a Hellickson of Philly. You know, he could be on their radar for what they're willing to give up. And if that's the case, is he an upgrade over their 4 and 5 at this rate? You'd probably say yes. So, you know, there would be an improvement there as well as adding depth. So, I think ideally they'd like to get, you know, a Pineda from the Yankees if he is indeed available. You're going to hear Archer's name. You'll hear Odorizzi's name. And, you know, the question will be what the return is. They don't really want to peel off the, you know, the 25-man roster. You know, you've seen Echeverria's name thrown out there in the possible Archer-type trade. But I don't see the Marlins creating a hole at shortstop to address pitching. That's not really where they are right now.